There was a wide, flat stone lying nearby, and after searching, he found a smaller, triangular one that could fit conveniently in the palm of his hand. He knelt beside his little fireplace and began methodically to hit the flat one with the pointed one. Nothing in particular happened. A hopeless feeling began to grow in him. "Here I am," he thought, "a grown man who can read and write, who can drive a car, who can even operate a computer, more or less. I can turn out a newspaper column in 2 hours that everybody in Sorrow City will want to read. And I can do it day in, day out for 20 years. But I can't start a fire in the wilderness. On the other hand," he thought, "I will not eat this graven raw unless I absolutely have to. Will not. Will not. Not, not, not." In fury, he struck the stones together. Again. 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 "Spark, damn you! Light! Burn! Cook this ridiculous, pathetic animal for me!" Again. Again. Again.
"What are you doing there, mister?"
an unfriendly voice asked suddenly from a point just behind his right shoulder. Theremin looked up, startled, dismayed. The first rule of survival in this forest was that you must never let yourself get so involved in anything that you failed to notice strangers sneaking up on you. There were 5 of them, men about his own age. They looked as ragged as anyone else living in the forest. They didn't seem especially crazy as people went these days. No glassy eyes, no drooling mouths. Only an expression that was grim and weary and determined. They didn't appear to be carrying any weapons other than clubs, but their attitude was distinctly hostile. 5 against 1. All right, he thought, take the damned graben and choke on it. He wasn't foolish enough to try to put up a fight.
"I said, what are you doing there, mister?"
the first man repeated more coldly than before. Theremin glared. "What does it look like? I'm trying to start a fire."
"That's what we thought."
The stranger stepped forward. Carefully, deliberately, he aimed a kick into Theremin's little woodpile. The painstakingly assembled kindling wood went scattering, and the skewered graven toppled to the ground.
"Hey, wait a second. No fires here, mister. That's the law."
Brusquely, firmly, bluntly.
"Possession of fire-making equipment is prohibited. This wood is to use for a fire, that's obvious. And you admit guilt, besides."
"Guilt?" Theremin said incredulously.
"You said you are making a fire. These stones, they seem to be fire-making equipment, right? The law's clear on that. Prohibited."
At a signal from the leaders, 2 of the others came forward. One grabbed Theremin about the neck and chest from behind. The other took the 2 stones he had been using from his hands and hurled them into the lake. They splashed and disappeared. Theremin, watching them go, felt the way he imagined Binet must have felt at seeing his telescope smashed by the mob.
"Let go of me!" Theremin muttered, struggling.
"Let go of him," said the leader.
He dug his foot into Theremin's fireside again, grinding the bits of straw and stems into the dirt.
"Fires aren't allowed anymore," he said to Theremin. "We've had all the fires we're ever going to have. We can't permit no more fires on account of the risk, the suffering, the damage. Don't you know that? You try to build another fire and we're going to come back and smash your head in. You hear me?"
"It was fire that ruined the world," one of the others said.
"Fire that drove us from our homes. Fire's the enemy. Fire's forbidden. Fire is evil."
Theremin stared. Fire? Evil? Fire forbidden? So they were crazy after all.
"The penalty for trying to start a fire, first offense," the first man said, "is a fine. We fine you, this animal here. It teaches you not to endanger innocent people. Now take it, Listigan. It's a good lesson to him. Next time this fellow catches something, he'll remember that he oughtn't to try to conjure up the enemy just because he feels like having some cooked meat."
"No," Theremin cried in a half-strangled voice as Listigan bent to pick up the graven. "That's mine, you morons! Mine! Mine!" And he charged wildly at them, all caution swept away by exasperation and frustration. Someone hit him hard in the midsection. He gasped and gagged and doubled over, clutching his belly with his arms. And someone else hit him from behind, a blow in the small of the back that nearly sent him tumbling forward on his face. But this time he jabbed backward sharply with his elbow, felt a satisfying contact, heard a grunt of pain. He had been in fights before, but not for a long, long time, and never 1 against 5. But there was no running away from this one now. What he had to do, he told himself, was stay on his feet and keep on backpedaling until he was up against the rock wall, where at least they couldn't come at him from the rear. And then just try to hold them off, kicking and punching and, if necessary, biting and roaring until they decided to let him be. A voice, somewhere deep within him, said, "They're completely nuts. They're perfectly likely to keep this up until they beat you to death." Nothing he could do about that now, though, except try to hold them off. He kept his head down and punched as hard as he could, while steadily pushing onward toward the wall. They crowded around him, battering him from all sides, but he stayed on his feet. Their numerical advantage wasn't as overwhelming as he had expected. In these close quarters, the five of them were unable all to get him at once, and Theramon was able to play the confusion to his own benefit, striking out in any direction and moving as quickly as he could while they lumbered around trying to avoid hitting each other. Even so, he knew he couldn't take much more. His lip was cut and one eye was starting to swell, and he was getting short of breath. One more good punch could send him down. He held one arm in front of his face and struck with the other while continuing to back toward the shelter of the rock wall. He kicked someone. There was a howl and a curse. Someone else kicked back. Theramon took it on his thigh and swung around, hissing in pain. He swayed. He struggled desperately for air. It was hard to see, hard to tell what was going on. They were all around him now, fists flailing at him from all sides. He wasn't going to reach the wall. He wasn't going to stay on his feet much longer. He was going to fall, and they were going to trample him, and he was going to die. Going to die. Then he became aware of confusion within the confusion, the shouts of different voices, new people mingling in with the melee, a host of figures everywhere. Fine, he thought, another bunch of crazies joining the fun, but maybe I can slip away somehow while all this is going on. In the name of the fire patrol, stop! A woman's voice called, clear, loud, commanding. That's an order. Stop, all of you. Get away from him. Now. Theramon blinked and rubbed his forehead. He looked around bleary-eyed. There were four newcomers in the clearing. They seemed fresh and crisp and were wearing clean clothes. Flowing green neckerchiefs were tied about their throats. They were carrying needle guns. The woman, she appeared to be in charge, made a quick imperative gesture with the weapon she held, and the five men who had attacked Theramon moved away from him and went obediently to stand in front of her. She glowered sternly at them. Theramon stared in disbelief. "What's this all about?" she asked the leader of the five in a steely tone.
"He was starting a fire. Trying to, he was going to roast an animal, but we came along."
"All right. I see no fire here. The laws have been maintained. Clear off." The man nodded. He reached down to take the graben.
"Hey, that belongs to me,"
Theramon said hoarsely.
"No," the other said. "You have to lose it. We fined you for breaking the fire laws."
"I'll decide the punishment," the woman said. "Leave the animal and clear off."
"Clear off." "But clear off or I'll have you up on charges before Altenol. Get. Get."
The five men went slinking away. Theramon continued to stare. The woman wearing the green neckerchief came toward him. "I guess I was just in time, wasn't I, Theramon?"
"Sephara," he said in amazement. "Sephara."
37. He was hurting in 100 places. He wasn't at all sure how intact his bones were. One of his eyes was practically swollen shut, but he suspected he was going to survive. He sat leaning against the rock wall, waiting for the haze of pain to diminish a little. Sephara said, "We've got a little jungler brandy back at our headquarters. I can authorize you to have some, I guess. For medicinal purposes, of course."
"Brandy? Headquarters? What headquarters? What is all this about, Sephara? Are you really here at all?"
"You think I'm a hallucination?" She laughed and dug her fingertips lightly into his forearm. "Is that a hallucination, would you say?" He winced.
"Careful. I'm pretty tender there. And everywhere else right now. You just dropped right down out of the sky, is that it?"
"I was on patrol duty, passing through the forest, and we heard the sounds of a scuffle. So we came to investigate. I had no idea you were mixed up in it until I saw you. We're trying to restore order around here somehow."
"We?"
"The fire patrol. It's as close as there is to a new local government. The headquarters is at the university sanctuary, and a man named Altenol, who used to be some sort of company executive, is in charge. I'm one of his officers. It's a vigilante group, really, which has managed to put across the notion that the use of fire must be controlled, and that only members of the fire patrol have the privilege of..." Theramon raised his hand.
"Hold on, Sephara. Slow down, will you? The university people in the sanctuary have formed a vigilante group, you say? They're going around putting out fires? How can that be? Sheeran told me that they all had cleared out, that they had gone south to some sort of rendezvous at Tamgondo National Park."
"Sheeran? Is he here?"
"He was. He's on his way to Mgondo now. I decided to stick around here a little while longer."
It seemed impossible to tell her that he had stuck around on the unlikely chance that he would manage to find her. Sephara nodded. "What Sheeran told you was true. All the university people left the sanctuary the day after the eclipse. I suppose they're off in Mgondo by now.
I haven't heard anything about them. They left the sanctuary wide open, and Altenahl and his bunch wandered in and took possession of it. The fire patrol has 15-20 members, all of them in pretty good shape mentally. They've been able to establish their authority over about half the area of the forest, and some of the surrounding territory of the city where people are still living.
And you? Theramin asked. How did you get involved with them?
I went into the forest first once the stars were gone, but it looked pretty dangerous here, so when I remembered about the sanctuary, I headed there. Altenahl and his people were already there. They invited me to join the patrol.
Sephara smiled in what might have been a rueful way.
They didn't really offer me much of a choice, she said. They aren't particularly gentle sorts.
These aren't gentle times.
No, so I decided better off with them than drifting around on my own. They gave me this green neckerchief. Everybody around here respects it. And this needle gun. People respect that, too.
So you're a vigilante, Theramin said, musing. Somehow I never figured you for that kind of thing.
I never did either.
But you believe that this Altenahl and his fire patrol are righteous folk who are helping to restore law and order, is that it?
She smiled again, and again it was not an expression of mirth.
Righteous folk?
They think they are, yes.
You don't.
A shrug. They're out for themselves first, and no kidding about that. But there's a power vacuum here, and they mean to fill it. But I suppose they're not the worst possible people to try to impose a governmental structure right now. They're easier to take than some of the outfits I can think of, at least.
You mean the Apostles? Are they trying to form a government, too?
Very likely they are, but I haven't heard anything about them since it all happened. Altenahl thinks that they're still hidden away underground somewhere, or that Mondeor has led them off to some place far out in the country where they'll set up their own kingdom. But we've got a couple of new fanatic groups that are real Lulus, Theramin. You just had a run-in with one of them. And it's only by wild luck that they didn't finish you off. They believe that the only salvation for humanity now is to give up the use of fire completely, since fire has been the ruin of the world. So they're going around destroying fire-making equipment wherever they can find it, and killing anyone who seems to enjoy starting fires.
I was simply trying to cook some dinner for myself, said Theramin somberly.
Sephara said, It's all the same to them whether you're cooking a meal or amusing yourself with a little bit of arson.
Fire is fire, and they abhor it. Lucky thing for you that we came along in time.
They accept the authority of the fire patrol. We're the elite, you understand, the only ones whose use of fire will be tolerated.
It helps to have needle guns, Theramin said. That gets you a lot of toleration, too. He rubbed a sore place on his arm and looked off bleakly into the distance. There are other fanatics besides these, you say?
There are the ones who think the university astronomers had discovered the secret of making the stars appear. They blame Aethor, Bina, and company for everything that's happened. It's the old hatred of the intellectual that crops up whenever medieval emotions start surfacing.
Gods! Are there many like that?
Enough. Darkness only knows what they'll do if they actually catch any university people who haven't already reached Umgando safely. String them up to the nearest lamppost, I suppose.
Morosely, Theramin said, And I'd be responsible.
You?
Everything that's happened is my fault, Sephara. Not Aethor's, not Fallenon's, not the gods, but mine. Mine.
Me. Theramin 762.
That time you called me irresponsible?
You were being too easy with me. I wasn't just irresponsible. I was criminally negligent.
Theramin, stop it. What's the good of...
He swept right on.
I should have been writing columns day in and day out, warning of what was coming, crying out for a crash program to build shelters, to set aside provisions and emergency generating equipment, to provide counseling for the disturbed, to do a million different things. And instead, what did I do? Sneered. Poked fun at the astronomers in their lofty tower. Made it politically impossible for anyone in the government to take Aethor seriously.
Theramin, you should have let those crazies beat me to death, Sephara.
His eyes met hers. She looked angry.
Don't talk like a fool. All the government planning in the world wouldn't have changed anything. I wish you hadn't written those articles too, Theramin. You know how I felt about them. But what does any of that matter now? You were sincere in what you felt. You were wrong, but you were sincere. And in any case, there's no sense speculating about what might have been. What we have to deal with now is what is.
More gently, she said, Enough of this. Are you able to walk?
We need to get you back to the sanctuary. A chance to wash up, some fresh clothes, a little food in you.
Food?
The university people left plenty of provisions behind.
Theremin chuckled and pointed to the graben.
You mean I don't have to eat that?
Not unless you really want to. I suggest you give it to someone who needs it more than you do while we're on our way out of the forest.
A good idea.
He pulled himself to his feet slowly and painfully. Gods, the way everything was hurting. An experimental step or two. Not bad, not bad. Nothing seemed to be broken after all. Just a little bit misused. The thought of a warm bath and actual substantial food was healing his bruised and aching body already. He took a last look around at his little flung-together lean-to, his stream, his scruffy little bushes and weeds, his home these strange few days. He wouldn't miss it much, but he doubted that he'd forget his life here very soon either. Then he picked up the graben and slung it over his shoulder.
"Lead the way," he said to Sephira.
They had not gone more than 100 yards when Theremin caught sight of a group of boys skulking behind the trees. They were the same ones, he realized, who had flushed the graben from its burrow and hunted it to its death. Evidently, they had come back to search for it. Now, sullenly, they were staring from a distance, obviously annoyed that Theremin was walking off with their prize. But they were too intimidated by the green neckerchiefs of office that identified the fire patrol group, or more likely, simply by their needle guns, to stake a claim to it.
"Hey," Theremin called. "This is yours, isn't it? I've been taking care of it for you."
He flung the carcass of the graben toward them. It fell to the ground well short of the place where they were, and they hung back, looking mystified and uneasy. They were obviously eager to have the animal, but afraid to come forward.
"There's life in the post-nightfall era for you," he said sadly to Sephira. "They're starving, but they don't dare make a move. They think it's a trap. They figure that if they step out from those trees to get the animal, we'll shoot them down just for fun."
Sephira said, "Who can blame them? Everyone's afraid of everyone now. Leave it there. They'll go after it when we're out of sight." He followed her onward, limping as he went. Sephira and the other patrol people moved confidently through the forest, as though invulnerable to the dangers that were lurking everywhere. And indeed, there were no incidents as the group headed as rapidly as Theremin's injuries permitted toward the road that ran through the woods. It was interesting to see, he thought, how quickly society was beginning to reconstitute itself. In just a few days, an irregular outfit like this fire patrol had begun to take on a kind of governmental authority. Unless it was just the needle guns and the general air of self-assurance that kept the crazies away, of course. They came to the edge of the forest finally. The air was growing cooler and the light was uncomfortably dim, now that Patru and Trey were the only suns in the sky. In the past, Theremin had never been bothered by the relatively low light levels that were typical of the hours when the only illumination came from one of the double sun pairs. Ever since the eclipse, though, such a two-sun evening had seemed disturbing and threatening to him, a possible harbinger, although he knew it could not be so, of the imminent return of darkness. The psychic wounds of nightfall would be a long time healing, even for the world's sturdiest minds. "The sanctuary's just a little way down this road," Sephira said. "How are you doing?"
"I'm all right," said Theremin sourly. "They didn't cripple me, you know." But it was a considerable struggle to force his sore, throbbing legs to carry him along.
He was intensely gladdened and relieved when at last he found himself at the cave-like entrance to the underground domain that was the sanctuary. The place was like a maze. Caverns and corridors led off in all directions. Vaguely in the distance, he saw the intricate loops and coils of scientific-looking gear, mysterious and unfathomable, running along the walls and the ceiling. This place, he remembered now, had been the site of the university's atom smasher, until the big new experimental lab at Sorrow Heights opened. Apparently, the physicists had left a good deal of obsolete equipment behind. A tall man appeared, radiating authority. Sephira said, "This is Altenal 111. Altenal, I want you to meet Theremin 762.
"Of the Chronicle?" Altenal said.
He didn't sound awed or in any way impressed. He seemed merely to be registering the fact out loud. "Formerly," said Theremin. They eyed each other without warmth. Altenal, Theremin thought, looked to be a very tough cookie indeed. A man in early middle age, obviously trim and in prime condition. He was well-dressed in sturdy clothing and carried himself with the air of someone who was accustomed to being obeyed. Theremin, studying him, riffled quickly through the well-stocked files of his memory. and after a moment was pleased to strike a chord of recognition. He said, "Morthane Industries? That Altenall?" A momentary flicker of amusement, or was it annoyance, appeared in Altenall's eyes.
"That one, yes."
"They always said you wanted to be prime executive. Well, it looks like you are now, of what's left of Cyril City at least, if not the whole Federal Republic." "One thing at a time," Altenall said. His voice was measured. "First, we try to stumble back out of anarchy. Then we think about putting the country together again and worry about who's going to be prime executive. We have the problem of the Apostles, for example, who have seized control of the entire north side of the city and the territory beyond and placed it under religious authority. They won't be easy to displace." Altenall smiled coolly. "First things first, my friend." "And for Theramon," Sephira said, "the first thing is a bath and then a meal. He's been living in the forest since nightfall." "Come with me," she said to him. Partitions had been set up all along the old particle accelerator track, carving it up into a long series of little rooms. Sephira showed him to one in which copper pipes mounted overhead carried water to a porcelain tank. "It won't be really warm," she warned him. "We only run the boilers a couple of hours a day because the fuel supply is so low. But it's bound to be better than bathing in a chilly forest stream. You knew something about Altenall?"
"Chairman of Morthane Industries. The big shipping combine. He was in the news a year or two back, something about wangling a contract by possibly irregular means to develop a huge real estate tract on government land in Nebro Province."
"What does a shipping combine have to do with real estate development?" Sephira asked.
"That's exactly the point. Nothing at all. He was accused of using improper government influence, something about offering lifetime passes on his cruise line to senators, I think." Theramon shrugged. "It makes no difference now, really. There's no more Morthane Industries, no more real estate developing to be done, no federal senators to bribe. He probably didn't like my recognizing him."
"He probably didn't care. Running the fire patrol is all that matters to him now."
"Well, for the time being," said Theramon. "Today, the Sorrow City Fire Patrol, tomorrow the world. You heard him talking about displacing the Apostles who've grabbed the far side of the city. Well, someone's got to do it. And he's the kind who enjoys running things."
Sephira went out. Theramon lowered himself into the porcelain tank. Not exactly sybaritic, but pretty wonderful after all he'd been through lately. He leaned back and closed his eyes and relaxed, and luxuriated. Sephira took him to the sanctuary dining hall, a simple tin-roofed chamber, when he was finished with his bath, and left him there by himself, telling him that she had to make her day's report to Altenall. A meal was waiting for him there, one of the packaged dinners that had been stockpiled here in the months that the sanctuary was being set up. Lukewarm vegetables, tepid meat of some unknown kind, a pale green non-alcoholic drink of nondescript flavor. It all tasted wondrously delicious to Theramon. He forced himself to eat slowly, carefully, knowing that his body was unaccustomed to real food after his time in the forest. Every mouthful had to be thoroughly chewed, or he'd get sick, he knew, though his instinct was to bolt it as fast as he could and ask for a second helping. After he had eaten, Theramon sat back, staring dully at the ugly tin wall. He wasn't hungry anymore, and his frame of mind was beginning to change for the worse. Despite the bath, despite the meal, despite the comfort of knowing he was safe in this well-defended sanctuary, he found himself slipping into a mood of the deepest desolation. He felt very weary, and dispirited, and full of gloom. It had been a pretty good world, he thought. Not perfect, far from it, but good enough. Most people had been reasonably happy. Most were prosperous. There was progress being made on all fronts, toward deeper scientific understanding, toward greater economic expansion, toward stronger global cooperation. The concept of war had come to seem quaintly medieval, and the age-old religious bigotries were mostly obsolete, or so it had seemed to him. And now it was all gone in one short span of hours, in a single burst of horrifying darkness. A new world would be born from the ashes of the old, of course. It was always that way. Sephira's excavations at Thombo testified to that. But what sort of world would it be? Theramon wondered. The answer to that was already at hand. It would be a world in which people killed other people for a scrap of meat,
or because they had violated a superstition about fire, or simply because killing seemed like a diverting thing to do. A world in which the Altenals came forward to take advantage of the chaos and gain power for themselves. A world in which the Follymans and the Mondiors, no doubt, were scheming to emerge as the dictators of thought. Probably working hand in hand with the Altenals, Theramun thought morbidly. A world in which... No. He shook his head. What was the point of all this dark, brooding lamentation? Sephera had the right notion, he told himself. There was no sense in speculating about what might have been. What we have to deal with is what is. At least he was alive, and his mind was pretty much whole again, and he had come through his ordeal in the forest more or less intact, aside from a few bruises and cuts that would heal in a couple of days. Despair was a useless emotion now. It was a luxury that he couldn't allow himself, any more than Sephera would allow herself the luxury of still being angry at him over the newspaper pieces he had written. What was done was done. Now it was time to pick up and move onward, regroup, rebuild, make a fresh start. To look back was folly. To look forward in dismay or despondency was mere cowardice. Finished? Sephera said, returning to the dining hall. I know, not magnificent food, but it beats eating graben. I couldn't say. I never actually got to eat any graben. You probably didn't miss much. Come, I'll show you to your room. It was a low-ceilinged cubicle of no great elegance, a bed with a godlight on the floor beside it, a washstand, a single dangling light fixture. Scattered in one corner were some books and newspapers that must have been left behind by those who had occupied this room on the evening of the eclipse. Theramun saw a copy of the Chronicle, opened to the page of his column, and winced. It was one of his last pieces, a particularly intemperate onslaught on Aethor and his group. He reddened and pushed it out of sight with his foot. Sephera said, "What are you going to do now, Theramun?" "Do? I mean, once you've had a chance to rest up a little." "I haven't given it much thought. Why?" "Altenhall wants to know if you're planning to join the fire patrol," she said. "Is that an invitation?" "He's willing to take you aboard. You're the kind of person that he needs. Someone strong. Someone capable of dealing with people." "Yes," Theramun said. "I'd be good here, wouldn't I?" "But he's uneasy about one thing. There's room for only one boss in the patrol, and that's Altenhall. If you joined up, he'd want you to understand right from the beginning that what Altenhall says goes, without any argument. He's not sure how good you are at taking orders." "Now, I'm not so sure how good I am at that either," Theramun said. "But I can see Altenhall's point of view. Will you join us, then? I know there are problems with the whole patrol setup, but at least it's a force for order, and we need something like that now. And Altenhall may be high-handed, but he's not evil. I'm convinced of that. He simply thinks the times call for strong measures and decisive leadership, which he's capable of supplying." "I don't doubt that he is." "Think it over this evening," Sephera said. "If you want to join, talk to him tomorrow. Be frank with him. He'll be frank with you. You can be certain of that. So long as you can assure him that you're not going to be any direct threat to his authority, I'm certain that you and he..." "No," Theramun said suddenly. "No what?" He was silent for a time. At length he said, "I don't need to spend the evening thinking about it. I already know what my answer will be." Sephera looked at him, waiting. Theramun said, "I don't want to butt heads with Altenhall. I know the kind of man he is, and I'm very sure that I can't get along with people like that for any length of time. I also know that in the short run it may be necessary to have operations like the fire patrol, but in the long run, they're a bad thing. And once they're established and institutionalized, it's very hard to get rid of them. The Altenhalls of this world don't give up power voluntarily. The little dictators never do. And I don't want the knowledge that I helped put him on top hanging around my neck for the rest of my life. Reinventing the feudal system doesn't strike me as a useful solution for the problems we have now. So, it's no-go, Sephera. I'm not going to wear Altenhall's green neckerchief. There isn't any future for me here." Quietly, Sephera said, "What are you going to do then?" "Sheeran told me that there's a real provisional government being formed at Amgondo Park. University people, maybe some people from the old government, representatives from all over the country, coming together down there. As soon as I'm strong enough to travel, I'm going to head for Amgondo." She regarded him steadily. She made no reply. Theramun took a deep breath and said after a moment, Come with me to Umgando Park, Sephira. He reached a hand toward her. Softly, he said, stay with me this evening, in this miserable little tiny room of mine, and in the morning, let's clear out of here and go down south together. You don't belong here any more than I do. And we stand 5 times as much chance of getting to Umgando together than we would if either of us tried to make the journey alone. Sephira remained silent. He did not withdraw his hand. Well, what do you say? Theremin watched the play of conflicting emotions moving across her features. But he did not dare try to interpret them. Clearly, Sephira was struggling with herself. But then, abruptly, the struggle came to an end. Yes, she said at last. Yes, let's do it, Theremin. And moved toward him, and took his hand, and switched off the dangling overhead light, though the soft glow of the godlight beside the bed remained. 38. Do you know the name of this neighborhood? Sephira asked. She stared, numbed, dismayed at the charred and ghastly landscape of ruined houses and abandoned vehicles that they had entered. It was a little before midday, the 3rd day of their flight from the sanctuary. The unsparing light of Onos mercilessly illuminated every blackened wall, every shattered window. Theremin shook his head. It was called something silly, you can be sure of that. Golden Acres or Sorrow Estates or something like that. But what it was called isn't important now. This isn't a neighborhood anymore. What we have here used to be real estate, Sephira, but these days what it is archaeology, one of the lost suburbs of Sorrow. They had reached a point well south of the forest, almost to the outskirts of the suburban belt that constituted the southern fringes of Sorrow City. Beyond lay agricultural zones, small towns, and somewhere far in the distance, unthinkably far, their goal of Umgando National Park. The crossing of the forest had taken them 2 days. They had slept the first evening at Theremin's old lean-to, and the second one in a thicket, halfway up the rugged slope leading to Onos Heights. In all this while, they had had no indication that the fire patrol was on their trail. Altenal had apparently made no attempt to pursue them, even though they had taken weapons with them and 2 bulging backpacks of provisions. And surely, Sephira thought, they were beyond his reach by now. She said, the Great Southern Highway ought to be somewhere around here, shouldn't it? Oh, another 2 or 3 miles. If we're lucky, there won't be any fires burning to block us from going forward. We'll be lucky. Count on it. He laughed. Always the optimist, eh? It doesn't cost any more than pessimism, she said. One way or another, we'll get through. Right, one way or another. They were moving steadily along. Theremin seemed to be making a quick recovery from the beating he had received in the forest, and from his days of virtual starvation. There was an amazing resilience about him. Strong as she was, Sephira had to work hard to keep up with his pace. She was working hard, too, to keep her own spirits up. From the moment of setting out, she had consistently struck a hopeful note, always confident, always certain that they'd make it safely through to Umgando, and that they would find people like themselves, already hard at work there at the job of planning the reconstruction of the world. But inwardly, Sephira wasn't so sure. And the farther she and Theremin went into these once pleasant suburban regions, the more difficult it was to fight back horror, shock, despair, a sense of total defeat. It was a nightmare world. There was no escaping the enormity of it. Everywhere you turned, you saw destruction. Look, she thought. Look. The desolation, the scars, the fallen buildings, the walls already overrun by the first weeds, occupied already by the early platoons of lizards. Everywhere the marks of that terrible night when the gods had once more sent their curse against the world. The awful, acrid smell of black smoke rising from the remains of fires that the recent rains had extinguished. The other smoke, white and piercing, curling upward out of basements still ablaze. The stains on everything. The bodies in the streets twisted in their final agonies. The looks of madness in the eyes of those few lingering living people who now and then peered out from the remains of their homes. All glory vanished. All greatness gone. Everything in ruins. Everything. As if the ocean had risen, she thought, and swept all our achievements into oblivion. Sephira was no stranger to ruins. She had spent her whole professional life digging in them. But the ruins she had excavated were ancient ones, time-mellowed and mysterious and romantic. What she saw here now was all too immediate, all too painful to behold. And there was nothing at all romantic about it.
She had been able readily enough to come to terms with the downfall of the lost civilizations of the past. It carried little emotional charge for her. But now, it was her own epic that had been swept into the discard bin of history, and that was hard to bear. Why had it happened? She asked herself. Why? Were we so evil? Had we strayed so far from the path of the gods that we needed to be punished this way? No. There are no gods. There was no punishment. Of that much Sephira was still certain. She had no doubt that this was simply the working of blind fate, brought about by the impersonal movements of inanimate and uncaring worlds and suns, drawing together every 2,000 years in dispassionate coincidence. That was all. An accident. An accident that Kalgash had been forced to endure over and over again during its history. From time to time, the stars would appear in all their frightful majesty, and in a desperate, terror-kindled agony, man would unknowingly turn his hand against his own works, driven mad by the darkness, driven mad by the ferocious light of the stars. It was an unending cycle. The ashes of Thombo had told the whole tale. And now it was Thombo all over again, just as Theramin had said. This place is archaeology now. Exactly. The world they had known was gone. But we are still here, she thought. What shall we do? What shall we do? The only comfort she could find amidst the bleakness was the memory of that first evening with Theramin in the sanctuary. So sudden, so unexpected, so wonderful. She kept going back to it in her mind over and over. His oddly shy smile as he asked her to stay with him. No sly, seductive trick, that. And the look in his eyes, and the feel of his hands against her skin, his embrace, his breath mingling with hers. How long it had been since she had been with a man. She had almost forgotten what it was like. Almost. And always those other times there had been the uneasy sense of making a mistake, of taking a false path, of committing herself to a journey she should not be taking. It had not been that way with Theramin. Simply a dropping of barriers and pretenses and fears, a joyful yielding, an admission, finally, that in this torn and tortured world she must no longer go it alone, that it was necessary to form an alliance, and that Theramin, straightforward and blunt and even a little coarse, strong and determined and dependable, was the ally she needed and wanted. And so she had given herself at last, unhesitatingly and without regret. What an irony, she thought, that it had taken the end of the world to bring her to the point of falling in love. But at least she had that. Everything else might be lost, but at least she had that. Look there, she said, pointing, a highway sign. It was a shield of green metal, hanging at a crazy angle from a lamppost, its surface blackened by smoke stains. In three or four places it was punctured by what probably were bullet holes. But the bright yellow lettering was still reasonably legible. Great Southern Highway, and an arrow instructing them to go straight ahead. It can't be more than another mile or two from here, Theramin said. We ought to reach it by... There was a sudden high whining sound, and then a twanging crash, reverberating with stunning impact. Sephira covered her ears. A moment later, she felt Theramin hooking his arm through hers, pulling her to the ground. Get down, he whispered harshly. Somebody's firing. Who? Where? His needle gun was in his hand. She drew hers also. Glancing up, she saw that the projectile had struck the highway sign. There was a new hole in it between the first two words, obliterating several of the letters. Theramin, crouching, was moving in a quick shuffle toward the edge of the nearest building. Sephira followed him, feeling hideously exposed. This was worse than standing naked in front of Altenal on the fire patrol. 1,000 times worse. The next shot might come at any moment, from any direction, and she had no way to protect herself. Even when she pulled herself around the corner of the building and huddled up against Theramin in the alleyway, breathing hard, her heart pounding, she felt no assurance that she was safe. He nodded toward a row of burned-out houses on the other side of the street. Two or three of them were intact, down near the opposite corner. And now she saw grimy, shadowy faces peering out of an upstairs window of the farthest one. People in there. Squatters, I bet. Crazies. I see them. Not afraid of our patrol neckerchiefs. Maybe the patrol doesn't mean anything to them this far out of town. Or maybe they were shooting at us because we're wearing them. You think so? Anything's possible. Theramin edged forward a little way. What I wonder is, were they trying to hit us, and is their aim really lousy, or
Were they just trying to scare us? If they tried to shoot at us and the best they could do was hit the highway sign, then we could try making a run for it, but if it's just a warning...
That's what I suspected was. A shot that went astray isn't likely to have gone astray right into the highway sign. That's too neat.
Probably so, Theremin said. He scowled. I think I'm going to let them know we're armed, just to discourage them from trying to send a few scouts sneaking around one of these houses and coming up on us from the rear.
He looked down at his needler, adjusting the aperture to wide beam and maximum distance. Then he raised it and squeezed off a single shot. A bolt of red light sizzled through the air and struck the ground just in front of the building where the faces had appeared. An angry, charred spot appeared on the lawn, and wisps of smoke came curling up. Safira asked,
"Do you think they saw that?"
Unless they're so far gone that they aren't capable of paying attention, but my guess is that they saw all right and didn't like it much.
The faces were back at the window.
"Stay down," Theremin warned. "They've got some kind of heavy hunting rifle. I can see its snout."
There was another whining sound, another tremendous crash. The highway sign, shattered, fell to the ground.
"They may be crazies," Safira said, "but their aim is pretty damn good."
"Too good. They were just playing with us when they fired that first shot, laughing at us. They're telling us that if we show our noses, they'll blow us away. They've got us pinned down, and they're enjoying it.
Can we get out of here, down the far end of this alley?"
"That's all rubble back there, and more squatters waiting for us on the other side, for all we know."
"Then what are we going to do?"
"Set that house on fire," Theremin said. "Burn them out, and kill them if they're too crazy to surrender."
Her eyes widened.
"Kill them?"
"If they give us no other option, yes. Yes, I will. Do you want to get to Amgondo, or would you rather spend the rest of your life hiding out here in this alleyway?"
"But you can't just kill people, even though they...
Her voice trailed off. She didn't know what she was trying to say.
"Even though they're trying to kill you, Safira? Even though they think it's fun to send a couple of shots whistling past your ears?"
She made no reply. She had thought she was beginning to understand the way things worked in the monstrous new world that had come into being on the evening of the eclipse, but she realized that she understood nothing. Nothing at all. Theremin had crept out toward the street a short way once again. He was aiming his needler. The incandescent bolt of light struck the white facade of the house down the street. Instantly, the wood began to turn black. Little flamelets sprang up. He drew a line of fire across the front of the building, paused a moment, fired again, tracing a second line across the first.
"Give me your gun," he said. "Mine's overheating."
She passed him the weapon. He adjusted it and fired a third time. An entire section of the house's front wall was ablaze now. Theremin was cutting through it, aiming his beam toward the interior of the building. Not very long ago, Safira thought, that white wooden house had belonged to someone. People had lived there, a family, proud of their house, their neighborhood, tending their lawn, watering their plants, playing with their pets, giving dinner parties for their friends, sitting on the patio, sipping drinks and watching the suns move through the evening sky. Now, none of that meant anything. Now Theremin was lying on his belly in an alleyway strewn with ashes and rubble across the way, efficiently and systematically setting that house on fire. Because that was the only way that he and she could get safely out of this street and continue on their way to Amgondo Park. A nightmare world, yes. A column of smoke was rising within the house now. The whole left-hand side of its front wall was on fire, and people were leaping from the second-story windows. 3, 4, 5 of them, choking, gasping. 2 women, 3 men. They dropped down on the lawn and lay there a moment as though dazed. Their clothes were ragged and dirty. Their hair was unkempt. Crazies. They had been something else before nightfall. But now they were simply part of that vast horde of wild-eyed, uncouth-looking drifters whose minds had been unhinged perhaps forever by the sudden astounding blast of stunning light that the stars had hurled against their unprepared senses.
"Stand up," Theremin called to them. "Hands in the air. Now, come on, get 'em up."
He stepped out into full view, holding both of the needle guns. Safira came out beside him. The house was shrouded in heavy smoke now, and within that dark cloak, great, frightful gusts of flame were sweeping upward on all sides of the building, blazing like scarlet banners. Were there still people trapped inside? Who could tell? Did it matter?
"Line up there," Theremin ordered. "That's it. Face to the left."
They straggled to attention. One man was a little slow, and Theremin sent a needler beam blazing past his cheek to encourage his cooperation.
"Start running, now. Down the street. Faster. Faster!"
One side of the house caved in with a terrible roaring sound, exposing rooms, closets, furniture,
like a doll's house that had been cut away. Everything was on fire.